Tonight on Arena, Rory Nolan and Katrina Ennis on the wonderful world of O'Casey's short comedies, and Gavin Ring and Stephen McNeff on their new song cycle. Five one double 51551 is the text, and you can watch us if you are so inclined on rte.ie/arena. And immediately my first two guests are fixing their faces and getting into all kinds of characters. Sean O'Casey, best known for his 1920s trilogy, of course, The Shadow of a Gunman, Juno and the Paycock and The Plough and the Stars. In spite of the brilliant double act of Joxer and Captain Boyle in Juno, there are, of course, serious plays. These are, of course, serious plays with serious intent. Druid Theatre Company is about to remind us what a skilled and utterly comic writer O'Casey could be. They take to the road in February and March with three short comedies: Pound on Demand, Bedtime Story and End of the Beginning, a set of one-act plays Druid first toured in 2021. The cast includes Druid Ensemble members like Marie Mullen, Rory Nolan and Marty Ray, alongside Venetia Bow, Katrina Ennis and Liam Heslin. And with me in studio this evening is Katrina Ennis and Rory Nolan. As I was reading these plays today, and maybe if we start by talking, I suppose, about one where you carry a lot of the can, even the names of the characters are funny to start out with. Tell us about, and I'm going to get to which of the plays is it? That's got the Derry and the Barry.
Derry and Barry, oh yeah, that's the end of the beginning.
Yeah.
So Derry Beryl and Barry Derrill are two twits, essentially, straight out of kind of Laurel and Hardy stock type of characters.
Yeah.
One is very short-sighted and one is very pompous and self-important. And basically what happens in the whole play is that the setup is Lizzie, who's Derry's wife.
Yeah.
He challenges her to go out and mow the meadow, which is his job.
Yeah.
And she says, right, will you do all the housework? And he thinks this is going to be a doddle in the course. Then Barry arrives and all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, and I'll come back to that one, because another play, and this shows you the strength of O'Casey's women, Katrina. Bedtime Story. This really surprised me. And but we should say that Marty Ray is the BD or the DB, whichever
he's he's Barry Darrell.
You're Darry Beryl. In Bedtime Story, the character in there, it shows, first of all, I think, Katrina, O'Casey's absolute love of women and his awareness of perhaps, you know, men and their ways.
Absolutely. I mean, Angela Nightingale, she's a force to
even
be reckoned
again
with.
The name. Angela Nightingale,
she's
don't
brilliant.
Be fooled. Don't
totally.
Be fooled.
Yeah, she's quite Machiavellian and strong in her nature. And I suppose she is in a world where she knows her lot. She knows how to get it. And she meets this guy, John Joe, and says, I'll have his money and I'll play him. And look, it's great fun to play. And it's great fun to play a female character that is able to run rings around
the men
this
around
man.
Her. Yeah.
Do you know?
And one particular man, I suppose.
Yeah.
And again, we'll come back to a little bit more detail in each of the plays. And then the final play, which I think possibly touches on one of the big themes here, Pound on Demand. Money is kind of central to all of them, isn't it, Rory?
Yeah, it is. Or perhaps sort of wealth or one-upmanship or whatever. But yeah, Pound on Demand is basically about two drunken lads on a night of carousing, drinking around, and they've run out of money and they need to get a pound on demand. Two drunk lads who are in varying degrees of inebriation.
Yeah.
Jerry and Sammy. Sammy cannot string a word together, and Jerry's trying to get the money out of Sammy's account with his help for signing for the pound on demand.
With his help, indeed. And who are the Jerry and Sammy?
So
there?
Jerry, I play Jerry, and Marty will play Sammy.
Yeah, yeah. That two-hander aspect of things gives us a sense of it. Mm. But let us listen to you. Have an excerpt for me from Bedtime Story.
Well, this
oh,
is
sorry,
from
not from Bedtime Story.
End of the Beginning.
End of the Beginning,
yeah.
Which is where you're playing husband and wife. And this is the very opening of the play. They're in two separate rooms, I guess.
Yeah, he comes in and it basically sets up the whole theme of the
play itself. But it's, of this story.
Yeah, exactly.
Dishaving water's dead cold, woman. Do you hear me? This shaving water's dead cold.
Come down and heat it then.
Too much to do, I suppose. I'd do all that has to be done here three times over, and when all was finished, I'd be sighing for something to do.
If you had half of what I do here at the end of the evening, you'd be picked up dead out of the debris.
I would.
You would?
Sure.
Certain.
If I only had half to do.
Or less.
I'd be picked up out of the debris.
Out of the middle of it.
Dead.
As a mackerel.
I'm always challenging you to change places for a few hours, but you won't do it. I'd show you what a sinecure of a job you had here while I'm sweating out in the fields.
Go out and finish mowing the meadow. It'll only take you half an hour or so, and there's plenty of light in the sky still.
The meadow will do to be done tomorrow. Why don't you let me do what's to be done in the house and you go and mow the meadow? Why don't you do that? Don't you do that? You do that. Agony to look at you. Agony to listen to you. Agony. Agony to be anywhere near you.
I'd just like to see you doing what's to be done about the house. I'd just like to see you.
What is there to be done about the house? Will you tell us that?
There's the pig and the heifer and the hens to be fed and tended. There's ironing, cook and washing and sewing to be done.
Sewing? And only a button back and front to me so that it's next thing to a miracle that me trousers are kept from starting the neighbours talking.
If you say much more, I'll go out and mow the meadow and leave you to see what you can make of the housework.
Buzz off. Buzz off then, and I'll show you how the work of a house is done. Done quietly. Done with speed. And done without a whisper of fuss in its doing. Buzz off if you want to, and I'll show you and all your sex how the work of a house is done.
I'd say he will. Darry Beryl played there by Rory Nolan, and his wife Lizzie played by Katrina Ennis, and that's from one of the three short plays that Druid are bringing out on tour. It's called End of the Beginning. You know, when you listen to, first of all, the dialogue, Casey's dialogue, and those, you know, those short lines, which are, you know, you couldn't, they're like television high-speed comedy.
Yeah, they really are. They're like jewels in your mouth. I mean, sometimes when you approach O'Casey and you're looking at him on the page, he looks like he's written 3,000 or 4,000 words when a couple of would have done, you know. But actually, he's very economic in the writing, and so much happens in such a short space of time. I mean, that's the first minute of the play, and he's set up the whole thing, you know.
Because, of course, he does stay in to attempt the housework, and Lizzie does go out
to
mow the meadow.
And she comes back to a fine house at the end.
Yeah.
All hell breaks loose.
Yeah, let's not give away too much on what she comes back to.
I'm sure.
But I think, having heard the character of Darry, We're not expecting great things.
No.
Into the mix then comes Barry Darrell, played by Marty Ray, who is a different type. Because initially I thought, oh, this is going to be, because there's more than a touch of Captain Boyle in Darry, isn't there? In terms of that kind of, oh, I can do anything I want about the house.
There's a little bit of self-importance and a bit of pomposity in there. O'Casey's brilliant at these type of characters. He's brilliant for a double act. He has them all over the place. You could say that John Joe and Halibut in Bedtime Story are sort of a double act. Certainly Jerry and Sammy, Pound on Demand, you know, you've obviously got Choxer and the Captain. You have Seamus Shields and Davern.
In the Katrina play, where Katrina's playing Angela Nightingale.
So he's brilliant at these double acts, and he's brilliant at extracting the comedy and the drama out of two very different types of people, you know what I mean? So he's fantastic at doing that, and coupled with the language. But the other thing is as well, and people forget this, he's hilarious. He's really, really, really funny. Even with the famous Dublin trilogy, there's moments of great humour in it, you know, and a great levity and all of that. But like, these ones are like music hall, you know. Pound on Demand, End of the Beginning. It's slapstick Charlie Chaplin, Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, it's not a million miles off, as you say, music hall comedy and a music hall sketch, but there is more substance for sure in it than that. To what extent, and maybe in both your cases you could look at this, looking back on the O'Casey trilogy that you were both involved in, to what extent do you think these shorter versions were kind of like, you know, the way a painter might do a study of a section of a painting and spend time on that and then use it on a bigger canvas later on.
Yeah.
To what extent do you think he was kind of learning a bit about these characters and how they talked, and then he developed them further in the big plays.
Yeah. Well, I think, interestingly, I think these plays were written after.
After the trilogy.
I think, well, like, certainly Pound on Demand came in 1934. I thought it was 1939, but it's 1934. So they're a little bit after.
Yeah, that's my PhD thesis ruined. Yeah. I'd be planning
it
all
sorry.
Day.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to ruin your PhD, but the echoes of them are there, and there's a sort of the social warrior in O'Casey is still kind of there in these plays. You know, he talks about the two lads, like we said, in Pound of Demand, who says, you know, who don't get what they're looking for, and he's saying, I've been shunted about by public servants, you know, in their application for a pound of demand. You know, there's always the man, you know, in the play.
And some of it could have been written yesterday.
Whether that exactly, whether that's, you know, the church, possibly in Bedtime Story, you know, men being men in the end of the beginning, and of course the government
being the government
on demand. Yeah. You know,
Katrina, I have to say the character of Angela Nightingale. Yeah, there are echoes of Minnie Powell, because maybe you could give us the setup here. We meet her in a room very late at night with a young man Marty Ray.
With a very religious young
very Catholic young man.
With a very Catholic young man. And I totally agree with what Rory was saying. I think that social warrior is there.
Yeah.
And you see it particularly with his female characters. And I think that's why you can go, oh, they kind of all shadow each other. Because he's driving home this point all the time of these men dealing with these kind of cowardly men around them.
Women, of course.
And it's, which I love about Angela is she's taken control and gone, well, I'll play them at their own game. So she's obviously seen this very religious man, dupes them into all kinds of behaviour with them, and then
because initially you think, is he just going to use her, abuse her, and dump her out into the
street?
She
turns that on.
She totally turns that around, and I don't want again.
Yeah,
I don't
want to get
into. Don't want to get into the hows and whys of that. That's why I thought there's a touch of the mini power, a touch of it in there, isn't there?
And
from Shadow of a Gunman.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's...
Because also the man, the play by Marty Ray, has a flatmate, which echoes Seamus Davernan and Donal Shields.
Yeah, exactly. And as well, like, I suppose because I'd played Maisie Madigan, I can see that flurry of strength in Angela Nightingale. They're all there. There's like ghosts of them all speaking to each other. But for me, that's, I think... That was the nature of the women at the time, and probably still is to this day. It's why these plays still sing, and why audiences love them. And it's why, even with, you know, Lizzie, you can feel that argument happening in houses going, well, right, you do the housework then.
There's a great moment too in Bedtime Story where the Marty Ray character is saying, all I did was say a couple of lines of Yeats to her. And straight away, the character, couldn't possibly be O'Casey mouthing off here, is on about, what did he ever write anyway?
They're brilliant. It's brilliant.
Who wrote nothing only about, who am I?
Where am I? What am I?
Yeah. And he really has a go at him. And you can see possibly, certainly in the 1930s, which would have been, I suppose, post the Silver Tassie rejection.
Oh,
you can see how he's getting at him there.
He never misses an opportunity to throw in an old dig at WB.
Yeah, and tell me then a little bit more about, I keep wanting to call it Poundland. It's not Poundland.
A Pound on Demand.
A Pound on Demand.
Yeah. So we
could be rhyming slang for the play.
Well, absolutely, it could be. We might end up calling it that in rehearsals. But it's a great little, he calls it a sketch in one act, you know, and it is that sort of thing. It's like, it's sort of, a lot of these plays are like, they almost feel like a precursor to this sort of stuff you'd see like Fawlty Towers.
Yeah.
You know, there's kind of that mad capery, that slapstick thing, but there's also great story.
Because the characters are really rounded, despite the fact that a lot of them are half Egypt as well, but they're half not Egypt too.
And we're in O'Casey land, so we're dealing with a master writer who can cover an awful lot of ground in a very short time. And immediately, you know these people. I mean, this is obviously set, the Pound on Demand is obviously set in Dublin, but it's very universal, you know, Irish themes. They come into the bar, into the bar, do you hear me? They've come from the bar, whatever they've come from.
Yeah.
They've come into the post office. In like I said earlier, they're in various varying degrees of inebriation, and Jerry is obviously the driving force, going, he really needs his pound on the man. And they meet a wily postmistress played by the wonderful Venetia Bow, and a very self-important woman who's trying to send a letter to Tara Ringapatam, played by the wonderful Marie Mullen, and Liam Heslin plays a policeman that comes in later on. And once again, you know, it's just from those little simple things of trying to get, Jerry tries to get Sammy to just write his name down on the form to coincide with the bank book, and all hell ensues.
And other names that I forgot to mention in Bedtime Story, which the saints that Marty Reyes is worried, he kind of has, you know, the exclamations to Saint Ferdusius.
Oh, they're amazing.
And to Saint Coriolanus. You know? And it's that wonderful kind of, it's Dublin malapropisms, essentially.
Yeah, for sure. And all the time while he's on his knees praying to all these saints, you have this woman running around him, running rings.
And no mention what he's been at. What he's been at a half an hour previous.
Well, there you go.
It's the middle of the night.
No, you did it.
Yeah, and he has the lights off, and he's saying, you better get out before anybody sees you here. I'll be ruined.
Yes.
Thinks nothing of her reputation, of course, in the midst of all of that.
But that's the great thing about that character.
Yeah.
That she turns that on its head.
Of course, totally.
That's power for her. So.
And she, there's this constant reference to, you said a word of Yeats and you were up and I was up and the next thing you had me pulled down onto your knee. And of course his version of that is, I said Yeats and you jumped up into my lap. But that type of physicality is essential to the play itself. When you read that, you know it's happening, but to see it, I think it's probably a very different flavour.
100%. Yeah. And even getting to watch the other plays, I mean, they're amazing. You're howling laughing because the physical comedy that they also demand and is in the writing is just, you can't, it's just an amazing craft as well to watch.
End of the Beginning in particular, which is the one where Katrina is the wife, she heads out to mow the meadow and yourself, Darry Beryl and your friend Barry Darrell stay in the house.
Yeah.
But that's essentially, there are words between the two of them. But that section between the two of them, the middle of the play, is pure and absolute physical slapstick. And I guess there's no room. It has to be very precise physically. And, choreography.
Yeah, and we like you said earlier on, Sean, we did these before, but we'd come back to them and we'd kind of forgotten the exactitude that you have to have when you're approaching them. Because if it's not tight and if it's not on the, you know, on the, if the timing's off, the gag will fall apart. And you also have to do it when you're saying O'Casey's mouthful of wonderful words as well. But
because he, at one point, I mean, one of the biggest physical sections of it is he wants to trim his tummy because a woman has told him, do you know, if you've a bit of a flatter tummy.
Old Alice Lanigan.
Alice Lanigan. Don't mention her.
you'd be quite the catch.
And
he has this gramophone, like, you know, kind of YouTube fitness video.
Calisthenics for Beginners, I think it's called. And yeah, he switches that on.
And what's interesting about that is there's music playing along and the whole point is his not being able to keep up with the music or his going faster than the music.
Exactly right. And he's trying to keep in time, which is too fast. Then he slows it down, which is too slow. Then Barry comes in and he does it, and he's able to do it in a different way. So the two of them are completely, and it's all of those little things. You start with the script, and then you work on it, and you try to get the timing right. We're just lucky that we have a short, and we're able to
absolutely
to do that.
I'm thinking of the description of our Marty Reyes character in Bedtime Story, which is a constitutionally frightened chap. You know, he's so afraid that he's going to get caught with a woman in his room in this boarding house. I guess you've both touched on it. When these go down outside of the city, they may have be city plays, but even the mention of mowing the meadow shows at one time how close the city was, in fact, to rural Ireland, Katrina.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's O'Casey's strength as well. They're universal. These characters, they might be written from Dublin, but they're human beings, and the situations they're in are very simple, but there's something we can all relate to, and they're hilarious because they're so human. That's what I always feel even watching them. You just go, it's humanity at its best and worst, And that's what's so funny about them.
Yeah, and there is no point, Rory, if they're just Egypts.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's not interesting to watch.
No,
yeah.
It's not interesting to watch. It's not interesting to play. And if you were to do it that way, you'd be doing O'Casey a huge disservice. Because he really knows exactly what he wants to say, and he really knows what hook he's slinging at, you know, whether it be piety, like we said, or the government or whatever it is, or injustice. He was, you know, like we said, he hated all that injustice stuff. But I suppose, you know, the other thing that you, like, we were there today even in rehearsals and just turn around at the end of it going, God, I'm really, really enjoying it. Yeah. I'm exhausted, but I'm enjoying it because it's a huge mental workout for us as well as a physical workout. And in many ways, like we were touching on the exactitude of the comedy. In this.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like the famous thing that I think Stan Laurel said was that onions can make them cry. But to make them laugh is much harder. And you kind of find that, you know, the exactitude, like I mentioned, you have to be so tight with the comedies in a way that it didn't lend itself as much when we were doing the Dublin trilogy.
And I'm guessing, too, the physical stuff, it often strikes me, you're rehearsing that physical stuff and you're spending an hour and a half on one section of the play and you're exhausted after it. Then you get on stage, lasts about 25, 30 seconds.
Oh, yeah. that's exactly right. That's exactly what happened today. And we found a moment, we went, oh, we never tried that before. And of course, we're going over it. And we were literally an hour and a half for what will probably be about 15 to 20 seconds of stage time.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of work that has to go into to hopefully make all the people laugh.
Then it looks as if you're not acting.
Yeah.
Well, which is that's the trick to the whole game.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Thanks so much both for coming in to us. And you don't look at all tired. So
thanks very much.
Maybe you should come back for an evening rehearsal.
Yeah.
I suggest that, Gary. Would you like that?
You'd probably say we need it.
Three short comedies by Sean O'Casey opens at Roscommon Arts Centre on Friday the 7th of February. Directed by Gary Hines, of course. That's the Gary I was mentioning there. It tours then on to Ennis, Tralee, Limerick, Kilkenny, Wexford, Longford, Belfast, Dunleira and Cork. And it finishes in Galway on Sunday the 29th of March. And it kind of reawakens that lovely form that is the one-act play. Thanks to Katrina Ennis, Rory Nolan for being with us this evening. And you'll find out full details on the event on druid.ie. The life we imbue into art, specifically sculpture, lies at the heart of Adrian Duncan's new novel, The Gorgeous Inertia of the Earth. The book revolves around a restorative sculptor called John Molloy and asks questions about the divine, about love and about art. Living in a quiet alpine city, John meets sociologist called Bernadette. As their relationship develops, John has to grapple with distressing memories from his past. The Gorgeous Inertia of the Earth is Adrian Duncan's fourth novel. Books have been nominated for the Walter Scott Prize, the Edge Hill Prize, and twice for the Kerry Group Irish Novel of the Year Award in 2020. He won the John McGahern Annual Book Prize, and delighted to have Adrian Duncan sitting across the desk from me right now. I was thinking about, you know, the reality of what you've written about in various books previous to this, John. You've had architecture. You've had construction quite definitely in there and other kind of sciences. I don't know if we can say that there's any social aspect to them, but certainly sciences.
Yeah.
You were brought towards sculpture or this time. Why? What? Well, I mean, the opening paragraph in the book, is about these Bernadette and John, the two lead characters, visiting a statue, piece of sculpture.
Yeah, no, I suppose, like, I was originally a structural engineer for several years, and over the last, say, 5 or 6, maybe 10 years I've been writing, I've gone from writing about technicians, essentially, and now I've just started writing more so closer to people who are not technicians, or maybe artists, or whatever. So it's just kind of shifted as I've shifted away from my previous life as being an engineer and working in the industry of construction.
But I did wonder to a certain extent, you know, it's this permanent divide that is there in society and in people, in our own minds. Mm. Oh, yeah, the engineers, they're the guys that do the technical stuff. The mathematicians, they can do hard sums.
Mm-hmm.
Or the artists, they have the interesting side to think. within engineering, mm-hmm. within mathematics, there is artistry and there is beauty in there. Did you want to kind of
pull in the previous novels, did you want to pull up and state the case for those characters in that way?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, like, you know, at the same time, you say, if you look at certain bridges that are designed by engineers, you can see a remarkable beauty in them, because really what you're seeing when an engineer designs a bridge is an understanding of the material that most people don't have. And what you get then is a certain kind of grace in the bridge that's sort of quite direct, and you realise actually what you're looking at is something that's connecting two landscapes, and it's not drawing attention to itself beyond the fact that it's making a connection. And I think there's something really beautiful about that, and in that style of understanding, which is very human as well.
Yeah, and it's very easy to say, well, that's functional.
Yeah.
It takes the Lewis across Dundrum, or it takes, you know, the train over the River Lee, or over Malahide Estuary, you know. It's easy to see its practical value, but not to see its artistic value at the same time. So when you started to get stuck into John and Bernadette, you very quickly brought them to the statue of Achim and Bettina. Mm-hmm. They're in an Alpine city. This is where they first meet.
Yeah. So this statue actually is near my home in Berlin. It's in a small square called Arnhemplatz. And it's a piece of public sculpture. It was put there in 96 by a German artist called Michael Klein. It's a quite large, maybe 3 or 4 metre tall bronze statue. And I've just loved it for years and years and years. I loved the companionship that it shows, the ease of the companionship and the shape. The fact that it's two figures, but it's one thing. It's one continuous piece of material.
It's the male character, is he standing or sitting?
And he's sitting,
And the female character...
He's leaning back onto his chest. Yeah, and so I decided that for this book, I was just very obsessed by this image. This is how I often start writing anything, is by an obsession in objects. So whether it's bungalows, whether it's bridges, whether it's machinery on the countryside. And in this case, it was this sculpture. And so I decided was to pluck this sculpture and put it into a fictional city. That's sort of a mix of Innsbruck and Geneva. And I just call it I, because I couldn't call it one or the other, because that would have been unfair and untrue.
Because it isn't either.
It isn't either. No.
But it's not long before the two of them start to look at, well, how was this made? In particular, John is obsessed with, how was this made? What is the material within it? And how did they get the two things to look like one?
Yeah. Yeah, this is part of, obviously, so there's an obsession with kind of understanding how the thing works, how it was made, because both of them have got an artistic background. They have a curiosity for how this actually would have been put together and how it would have how the form would have been put together. So it stems from a photograph that I would have seen, and the photograph actually appears in the novel, where it shows Akeem with a massive kind of cavity in his chest, and this is the shape of Akeem's waiting, as it said in the novel, which is the rather poetic way of saying that this is how the thing fits together. But I came across this photograph in the archive of Klein's, who was the actual sculptor in Berlin. And I remember seeing that photograph, and I just thought it was something hauntingly beautiful about it.
Yeah, it's a lot better, the space, the way, what did you say the exact term?
The shape of Akeem's waiting.
The shape of Akeem's waiting, as opposed to the hole where Bettina will be, where Bettina's head will be, you know. No, it doesn't have that ring about it. And that's what struck me about the book itself. It's the nature of your writing within it. It's very quiet. And yes, there are lyrical passages like that very short phrase that you just gave us. But there's a kind of an ordinariness about what you're saying, the way you're saying things as well.
Yeah, and I think this is something that does stem back to this idea of, like, you know, we were talking about a bridge a couple of seconds ago and the beauty of something being quite functional, but also connecting. And I think about that in terms of sentences as well, that just actually producing something that's that connects me to a reader, it produces an intimacy that's, that I'm very, very interested in. I think the less ornate and sometimes the simpler sentences can be, the more intimacy you actually have with a writer than if you're actually trying to make them feel something, you know. So I think that stepping away a little bit from those big feelings can often draw the actual reader a little closer to what's been said.
And you do, and I presume this was heavy research, but I'm guessing from the way it's presented in the book, it was research that you et up.
Yeah.
you really get into what is the word for, you know, describing the way stone, the way it needs to be handled, the nature of how porous it is, how dense it is, how difficult it is to sculpt. What's that word? There's a word for it. Is it taxonomy?
The taxonomy of the stone, like as in the details of it. Yeah, the taxonomy of the stone.
You got stuck into a lot of that.
Well, that would have stemmed from when I was studying engineering. There was a course that we did, and I was quite angry at the time because it was during our Easter holidays, and I felt that there shouldn't be education during Easter holidays. But anyway, we were brought down to the east coast of near Stonehaven, because I stood in Aberdeen. Mm. We were brought down to Stonehaven and we were brought around beaches there and we were shown geological forms. And it's only now, looking back several years later, and I've got over my irritation at having spent my Easter there, that I can remember the beauty and the enthusiasm of the teacher.
And did you write to say thank you for that? It gave me the material from my
this novel. That's a very, very good point.
He deserves
it. In the end.
It got the gorgeous inertia of my Easter holiday eventually got me to think a little bit bigger than that. The book is very much in two parts, which is the echo of that sculptor that is at the centre of the piece as well. And we're talking about the relationship between John and Bernadette as well, which is obviously two people. Now, he has other friends, she has other friends. We, in the second part of the novel, we were in Bologna. Mm-hmm. You visited there several times. Choosing to set something in Bologna, though, must have had a very specific reason. This latter part of the novel, where I don't know how much you want to give away, but certainly things have changed in the life of one of John's friends.
Yeah. Well, my deep interest in Bologna stemmed from one particular night when I was in Bologna about maybe 7 years ago, and it was Halloween night, so All Saints night, and all of the churches stay open very late in Bologna on All Saints night. And if anyone who's been in Bologna will realise that the churches are imbricated into the town. So you could be walking down a very, very long colonnade, you come across a tiny little door, and you walk in through this tiny little door, and all of a sudden you're in an absolutely ginormous holy space. And I've found that experience, when it happened the first time, crossing that threshold from the real world into some other world, was absolutely jaw-dropping, because it was so unexpected. And then I just kept doing it, because there's so many of these little entrances all over Bologna, and I didn't know the city at first. And I ended up doing it loads of times that night, Halloween night, and having this extraordinary experience.
And the other aspect of those churches, or some of them at any rate, which are partly ruins at this point in time, when you look at a section of the wall that is visible, you see history.
Yeah,
it's kind of like geology, except that it's man's interaction. Yeah. You know, when churches were made bigger or wrecked and rebuilt, that in itself is very interesting too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that idea of this kind of a relationship between something being a ruin, but also being a kind of a form, and like it's kind of hard to tell when you come across a very old ruin sometimes. It's like, is that just a heap of stones, or where is the intention in that? How can I see the intention in that, you know? Mm. And I find that kind of moment very, very interesting, when you're kind of like, where and when did the intention stop appearing in that ruin, in that mound of stones, you know?
There's another aspect of the novel, and I'll take your lead on this. John is harbouring difficult memories from childhood. You can tell us as much or as little as you want to about those memories, but how does that play into what he's doing? Because in part two, one of his best friends is dying, and her partner has asked all her friends to pray for a quick death for
her. Yes, yeah. So in his childhood, his mother had a holy vision, and as a result was ostracised from, it was long before Ballinspittle and this 84 period, it was in the early 70s, and the local priest decided that this woman wasn't really having a holy vision, but was actually having a mental breakdown of some kind, and she was hospitalised. So this produced a sort of a trauma and an outsiderness in his life that carries right the way through to very late in his life, particularly this day in Bologna, when he's been forced to rethink all of this stuff again. And one word that actually came to mind when I was thinking about the whole second half of the book was a German word for reverence, and it's Ehrfurcht is the word. And when you break that down into two parts, you got Ehr, which has to do with honour, and Furcht, which has to do with terror, fear, great fear. And I had never thought that reverence, from the English position, ever contained fear. But then I thought that if it contains fear, then it must also contain bravery. And I had never had that thought before about reverence. And that was helped me understand the mother figure of the book as well.
There's also a sense in which John is kind of looking at a lost faith, or certainly a lapsed faith, because he has to learn how to pray again.
Yeah, I think he associates prayer with a kind of a disintegration of mind. And I think that...
Which was his mother's experience.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that to kind of be reverent and to give yourself over to the Lord, as it were, requires a certain sort of suspension of belief and disbelief of, you know, the actual world and the rational world and these kinds of things. And I think this for him is a fearful thing to do.
I have to ask you how many times you've been to Bologna. The porticos do get a mention because there are all of these, there's kind of porticos over the footpath, which is extraordinary because you never, even though it doesn't rain there as much, obviously, but you'll never get wet. Even cold or too warm because the porticos do the job, but they're kind of like little arches the whole way down the major streets. But the Italian food that you're eating is not a big whack of Irish spaghetti bolognese or anything like it. It's delicate in a way that Italian food is when you're in Italy.
No, there was when I was there, I have to say, a couple of really, really special just meals.
Hard research that.
That was the hardest part of the whole work.
I can imagine.
But there was one particular thing that I came across when I was there called Ascoli olives, and they're basically breadcrumbed olives, and they appear in the book as well, obviously, but they're absolutely unbelievably delicious.
Well, of course, the everything with the Italian food, the reason is it's so simple, is the produce is so incredibly fresh, and it's, you know, cooked for a couple of minutes. It's not again, you think of our bolognese. I'll put the bolognese on at 10 o'clock and we might eat it this evening. We might eat it this evening for dinner. The Gorgeous Inertia of the Earth, a wonderful title.
Thank you.
As well within that, because it stops you, which I guess is part of what it is. But I read a review which spoke about how you're not afraid to write about the still moments or the stillness of something, or in fact, you know, the beauty, the artistry in something that is inanimate. But of course, maybe life as well as beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah. Like, I think that's something that I think is really interesting about looking at artworks as well. Like, looking at art isn't part of being entertained. Like, you kind of have to do something as well yourself. You have to commit to looking at an artwork. And sometimes the first time you look at an artwork, you might not necessarily have got everything that was available or what was there. And I think that kind of patience and that kind of slow looking is a really important part of engaging with an artwork. And I think it's a really important part of being human as well. And I think certainly now, with the amount of entertainment that's available to us, that looking slowly at something wouldn't be a bad thing to be at as well.
Were you in any way conscious of that in terms of the writing of the book, which is a relatively short book? And some of the chapters, you know, have a couple of lines. And as you said, there are pictures in there as well. It's a 200 page book, which probably could be read, I would hazard, in two sittings, part one and part two. But had you a sense of, I want people to slow down while they're reading this and take their time with it?
Yeah, that was part of the sort of, when, so Colm Tobin worked as the editor on the book, which was obviously a real privilege for me, but also extremely, extremely interesting. I learned a huge amount from it. But it became clear as I kind of worked, as I was working on the book myself, that there needed to be absences between the writing, that there needed to be gaps. So if you think about one of the sculptures in the book, it's Critias Boy, this really famous old sculpture from ancient Greece, and his arms are missing and parts of his legs are missing. And this idea of, where are these arms? What would they look like if they were there? What does that absence, what would it look like? How can you draw it out? That's also what I was sort of trying to do within the book itself, to sort of leave these absences for the reader to carry out that act of extension and drawing.
Well, it's the old thing you say, that a work of art, you know, you have to look at it. The book, in inverted commas, doesn't exist without the reader actually reading it. Then it needs that double part to go back to the one of the very important themes, I think, within the book. Thanks so much for coming into us this evening, Adrian, and that very interesting conversation. That's Adrian Duncan. Adrian's new novel, The Gorgeous Inertia of the Earth, is out now, and it's published by Tusker Rock Press. An Irish premiere of new music is always something to look forward to, but when it's performed by our National Symphony Orchestra and sung by renowned singer Gavin Ring, then it's a truly special occasion. This Friday, January the 31st, at the National Concert Hall, the National Symphony Orchestra presents the Irish premiere of Stephen McNeff's song cycle, The Celestial Stranger, a National Symphony Orchestra co-commission with BBC National Orchestra of Wales, composed for and performed by Gavin Ring. I'm delighted to be joined in studio by both composer Stephen McNeff and singer Gavin Ring. I was saying during the previous song to you, Stephen, this is a song cycle that gives us an idea of a few tunes we might want to think about if an alien comes to Earth. But the idea from it is not very contemporary. It actually goes quite a bit back.
Yes, indeed. It goes right back to the 17th century mystic, cleric and mystic, Thomas Traherne, who wrote masses of poetry, even though he died as a relatively young man in obscurity. He came from Hereford in England, and a lot of his work was lost for many years. And this new series of work on which The Celestial Stranger is based was unearthed about 20, 25 years ago in the library of Lambeth Palace in London, which is the Archbishop of Canterbury's official residence. Now, who knows what other wonders this library may have?
And how long was it there? And why was it kept quiet? That, that might be another question.
That's a very good question. Yeah, I haven't delved
into that. You were busy composing music. You weren't getting into historical and political research around the text itself. But what did the text say that you really thought, this is the basis for a song cycle?
Because it's visionary. It imagines a person from a very unspecific part of the universe, spying Earth from a long way away and discovering there this paradise of, as they describe there, you know, new odours and colours and wonderful, kind people. And that image stuck with me. One or two people compared it to the kind of things. Do you remember when astronauts first went into space and reported back on seeing Earth, the blue planet from outer space, of how beautiful it was? And I'd had this idea for many years to write a musical setting. One of the things that held me up, interestingly enough, was that we couldn't establish who actually owned the rights to Thomas Traherne's work.
To the text?
Because when a text is, even though it's by a 17th century poet, when a text is published, that re-establishes the copyright. And my publishers, Peter's Edition, were very studious because they like to get these things right. Wow. But we decided, along with the Archbishop of Canterbury, as it were, that nobody really owned it anymore.
Well, that was a good decision.
Sent to music.
That was a good decision.
Well, we didn't want some relative popping up.
Well, the worst thing, you know, in those scenarios, suddenly something that would have cost you a reasonable amount of money, cost you a fortune because you didn't ask permission. Gavin, you had worked with Stephen before.
Yeah.
What was it about working? It was on the Bogland song.
The Ballads of a Bogman.
Ballads
of a Bogman. That's right, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, like, I was always a fan of Stephen's work even before we sort of collaborated together. And I suppose when we did finally get together for Ballads of a Bogman, I suppose he unleashed his full potential and his full power in terms of being able to write so well, not just, let's say, for the voice, but for me personally.
Right.
And it's a huge pleasure to perform his music and to be a part of his visions for pieces and his visions for compositions of, you know, they really are just, I can't tell you enough how much of a fan I am of this man here beside me. It really is tremendous.
Yeah, and I'll come back to you, Stephen, on what it is about the voice of Gavin Ring that particularly attracted you. Maybe the way he approaches work as well. It could be all of those things put together. But let us have a listen to an excerpt that you very kindly sent us. Now, the piece has already been performed in Wales because it was a co-commission,
as I said.
With BBC Wales.
BBC National Orchestra of Wales.
And the National Symphony Orchestra. So we're getting the Irish premiere on this coming Friday night. And this is the opening of the first song from Stephen McNeff's The Celestial Stranger song cycle. And the voice that you will eventually hear is that of Gavin Ring.
had a man been always in one of the stars, or confined to the body of a flaming sun, or surrounded with nothing but pure ether, pure ether, at vast and prodigious distances from the earth, acquainted with nothing but an azure sky, and
there we have the opening song in the song cycle, The Celestial Stranger. Gavin Ring was singing it there. And the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, which mm-hmm. Stephen McNeff has just helped me with the BBC Now acronym, which made it a lot easier to remember after you said that. So, I mean, I think lots of people in this country love Gavin Ring's voice. What when you're writing for somebody, and you had that experience with the Ballads of the Boglands, what does that give you, and what did you see in Gavin's voice that, and hear in Gavin's voice that made it right for this piece?
Well, I think we've just heard all the reason we need to hear to know why any composer would be attracted to a voice that was both lyrical, powerful, and expressive. I've had a long-lasting love affair with the human voice, of all types.
Yeah.
I've worked a lot in opera and in choral music. It's something I think I have an affinity with the human voice, and.
And in fact, as you were saying, in terms of this piece itself, the song cycle itself, I was asking, is that the stranger who's singing, is that him? And you quite rightly corrected me. Who says it's him?
Well, the poem, the series of poems is very unspecific. It could be male or female. In this case, I chose a male voice because I was particularly keen on working with a voice that I knew would be expressive. There are a lot of words. And, of course, I don't just set the words of Thomas Traherne.
I was going to ask you about the other poets that are in there, perhaps a little bit more modern, which might... I'm wondering how they sat together. Walt Whitman is definitely in there.
Yeah, well, I wanted to tell a story. And we first have our celestial stranger discovering the world, moving on to describe strange experiences as he or she experiences the earth, and he, our stranger, tells a story about jumping over the moon, in which actually what they're talking about is the reflections of the moon in water, and the notion that if you see the moon reflected in water, you could jump over it.
Yeah.
Wonderful idea. But then things become a little darker as our stranger encounters things on Earth which aren't quite so palatable.
Yeah, and we might understand why. Is it the final song in the song cycle, Farewell to Thee?
Farewell to Thee is the final song where our stranger takes a regretful leave, hoping to come back.
At a later date.
But the song we've had before that is a setting of Dylan Thomas's The Hand That Signed the Paper.
Ah, right, yeah. So
which is a dark world.
Yeah, it's not a place you'd be rushing back to.
No.
I'm sure performing it in Wales and that being the world premiere must have been a great moment, Gavin.
But it was wonderful, yeah.
Getting it home is a whole other ball game, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. I mean, look, it was on my bucket list in a way to perform with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. I've watched them afar for a long, long time, and it was fantastic to be able to perform Stephen's work with them for the world premiere. But as you say, it's a different ball game entirely to come home. And in many respects, you know, there's probably more pressure on this one.
Yeah, absolutely.
With a home crowd and to ensure that what you deliver is the very best, you know.
Let's have a listen to just about a minute of that final song, which is Farewell to Thee from The Celestial Stranger. Good how we can have something so sad with our poignant, I suppose is the word, with an upbeat and nice waltz feel to it. That is Gavin Ring singing the music of Stephen McNeff, who are both with me in studio this evening. Stephen's The Celestial Stranger with the National Symphony Orchestra, soloist Gavin Ring, which will be alongside the music of Debussy and Rachmaninoff, Prelude de l'après-midi d'un fauve in the case of Debussy and Rachmaninoff's Symphony No. 2, all on Friday, January the 31st, 7:30 p.m. and nch.ie for full details. That's our lot for this Wednesday evening. Yes, it is Wednesday. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy were the researchers. Cara O'Hara was on sound this evening, and the programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1, and Ray Cudahy will be with you after the news.